They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA Podcast. Got a good show for you this week. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer from Bleacher Report, he is going to join me. And we're going to talk about the finals. But the big news this week is that Doc Rivers is out in Los Angeles with the Clippers. Let go after fizzling out in the second round of these playoffs. We talk about what happened with the Clippers, who might be next for that team, is Phil Jackson a candidate for that job, and exactly where they go from here after the Doc Rivers era comes to an end. We also talk about the Celtics, where they go after losing in their third conference finals in 4 years. Stick around for that great conversation with Howard Beck. A little bit later on, Mike Breen, the voice of the NBA for ESPN and ABC. He joins me to talk about his experience calling games inside the bubble, calling games from behind plexiglass for the first time. Also his work with Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson. Plus, Mike has called all of LeBron's 10 finals appearances. Where does he see this finals appearance ranking against all the others? Stick around for that great conversation with Mike Breen as well. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure that I keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, on to my conversation with Howard Beck. All right, Howard Beck is here, senior writer over at Bleacher Report. Check him out on the Full 48 podcast as well. A terrific show. I'm sure most of you listen to it after you listen to this podcast, but definitely get to it from time to time. What's up, Howard?
Not much. I mean, I'm sure, you know, if they've got any time left after they've listened to your podcast, then maybe, you know, they'll give me a few minutes here and there.
God bless the people that listen to podcasts for, you know, hours on end. Like Joe Rogan has one of the most popular podcasts, maybe the most popular podcast out there. It's like 3 hours long, some of these things. Like my attention span is not that great. It's just
not. No, me either. And there are a lot of great pods out right now. There are a lot of NBA pods alone could just fill your entire day at this point, especially with players. Now Kevin Durant's got one. JJ Redick has his. CJ McCollum's got it. Like it's just proliferating, and it's getting to the point where I can't keep up. You and I are heavy users of media. Mm-hmm. I can't keep up anymore. We need to get back to commuting and gyms and stuff so that we actually have time to listen to podcasts while we're doing all that other stuff that we need to kill time.
That's true. You know, the gym experience was a good time to knock out a couple of them. So let's get them back open and up and running, and you know, we can start getting rid of the saturation of podcasts. All right, let's jump right in here, Howard. The big news this week is not the start of the NBA Finals on Wednesday. It's that the Clippers have parted ways with Doc Rivers, which a team always says they're doing when they fire a head coach, which is exactly what the Clippers did with Doc Rivers. Steve Ballmer had his fingerprints all over this, quoted multiple times in the press release announcing the release of Doc Rivers. Doc had one of the best winning percentages in the NBA in his 7 years on the job. His playoff performances left a little bit to be desired. Of course, the most recent one, blowing a 3-1 lead to the Nuggets in the second round of these past playoffs. I guess first, Howard, just your reaction to the Clippers letting go of Doc Rivers.
I was stunned. I mean, I got to say, I was stunned. I the disappointment over that second round exit obviously was palpable. And yes, we are used to this in this league. There are consequences when a team with championship aspirations falls short. But there were just so many circumstances, so many unique challenges this team had to deal with that this was not an outcome I really expected. I mean, it wasn't outside of the realm of possibility by any stretch, but given everything, no Pat Beverly, you know, or Montrezl Harrell or Lou Williams at times in the bubble, all those guys having to leave to deal with family issues, that being a disruption to their chemistry. The fact that even during the regular season before the restart, you had Paul George having to rehab his shoulders first, so he wasn't available at the start. Kawhi Leonard's being load managed. Those guys don't get a ton of time together on the court. Like, this team never really got a chance to establish itself. And look, I was among the people, and I think you might have been too, who leaned Clippers, not by a lot, but when we were, you know, making our flimsy prognostications last October, it was, hey, you know, the Clippers by a little bit over the Lakers because they had more depth behind their two stars. And they were legitimate contenders. And yeah, they fell two rounds short, but I don't think that that's on Doc. We could talk about, you know, Montrezl Harrell versus Ivica Zubac and all that stuff, you know, against Jokic. I get it, but he's a great coach, and he'd been there through the toughest of tough times, the Donald Sterling saga, when he was, you know, the conscience and beacon of that franchise to guide them through that. And you know, I just think this feels hasty. It feels hasty, and I don't buy the you know, assertions that this was somehow mutual parting of the ways. This very, very much looks like the Clippers said, we've decided to move on. And the only thing, the last thing I'll say, the only thing that makes sense to me is if they sensed that the team wasn't responding anymore, which happens, and teams internally know this better than we do on the outside, if they felt like there was some lack of response there, and or especially from their two stars who are both on 1 year deals now. And maybe they also thought that Ty Lue is ready to step in, because that's the other piece. You don't fire a coach of Doc's caliber without knowing where you're going with it next. You're not doing some like 20 person search or something. Maybe it's because they're already prepared to elevate Ty, and maybe Ty already has the buy-in from the stars.
Yeah. To me, this was a stunning overreaction. Doc absolutely, as the coach of a team that blew a 3-1 lead, deserved to be taken to the proverbial woodshed, you know, for that, you know, criticized, have his rotations criticized, his fourth quarter decisions criticized. Everything was fair game in dissecting this series. Did he deserve the basketball death penalty? No, he didn't. I mean, I didn't buy the whole Paul George argument of, you know, it was never championship or bust for us this season. You don't say stuff like that. But the number of teams that were put together basically on the fly and win a championship in their first year, you could probably count on one hand, maybe two hands. I know the Celtics did it back in 2008, but I mean, let's not forget Miami failed when they put their super team together. They lost in the finals to the Dallas Mavericks. Yes, the Clippers came up far shorter, you know, losing in that second round, but does it really matter when you lost? I mean, if you lose, you lose at that point. I didn't think that you needed to fire the head coach after this experience for all the reasons you articulated there. I mean, the fact that they had half a team, you know, for the first half of the bubble experience during the seeding games. Harrell didn't play his first game until the first playoff game. Patrick Beverley missed, you know, what, all but one game of the Mavericks series. They had major chemistry issues. But I go back, Howard, and I look at what they did before the pandemic hit. They had won 8 of their last 9 games. They were starting to play good basketball. They had beaten Oklahoma City. They'd beaten Denver. They'd beaten Houston. They were starting to peak in a way. Then everything gets shaken up and things change. And it's not an excuse. I mean, Denver had as many problems as the Clippers did. I mean, they had myriad issues, you know, coming into the bubble, but they still had the, you know, the intestinal fortitude to rally and, you know, win a series like that, come back from 3-1 down. But the idea that it required a coaching change, I unless you saw so much internal dysfunction before the pandemic, which I guess is possible, there were some issues with that team before the pandemic hit, chemistry issues, but unless you saw that, I don't understand the decision to bring Doc Rivers back. I'm with you. I think Ty Lue is probably a front runner for this job, but I'm not so sure that Ty Lue is any better of a fit for this situation than Doc Rivers.
Yeah, unless it's simply a matter of some player or combination of important players decided that Doc just wasn't the guy. Maybe he just lost the room. I mean, it does happen. The weird thing is, usually if you lost the room, it's because you've been with a team too long. Or maybe you didn't have the standing to begin with, like David Blatt. But in Doc's case, it's not like this is the same group he's had for 7 years. Like when we talk about, like, you know, the Larry Bird rule of after 3 years or whatever, or Phil Jackson has talked about sometimes after 5 years, your voice grows stale, your message grows stale. But this was a fairly newish group still, and certainly the two stars. I just think that for a team that overachieved a year ago, wins 48 games with no stars, and then you graft on these two guys who are both, you know, all NBA type players, but who've never played together with each other, much less that team that was very prideful about what they'd accomplished without them. You could see those strains. You could hear it. Montrezl Harrell said some stuff back in January.
Yep.
And those things, those are player personality issues. Those are not coach issues. Now, a coach, among the many, many duties a coach has in this league, is to try to tamp down those concerns and corral guys and get them on the same, like all that stuff. But it's not always possible. Sometimes it's just about the players. And whether it's the basketball side of it or the chemistry side of it and the personality side of it, I just don't think that this is laying at Doc's feet. They had concerns that went way beyond coaching. He's taking the fall for it for whatever reason. Maybe internally there's something else that we are not privy to at the moment in terms of the faith that, whether it's above him or below him, that they had.
I don't like that Ballmer's fingerprints were all over this. I get nervous. You know, if I was a fan of the Clippers, I'd be nervous when an owner makes basketball decisions. I mean, nowhere in that statement, Howard, was a word or a mention of Lawrence Frank, who's the team president. Who
really, really interesting, right?
Really interesting. Now, I would imagine Lawrence would have a very difficult time firing Doc Rivers because Doc effectively hired him, elevated him, and then watched as Lawrence kind of took that role and he went back to a full-time coaching capacity. All that being said, like, not even a cursory statement from Lawrence Frank, who is, you know, nominally running your team. He's supposed to be in charge of that organization. I thought that was, it was conspicuous in his absence. And I wonder, like, what did Ballmer think this season was going to be? Like, did he go into this year thinking, we got Kawhi, so we're Toronto? Like, we're Toronto now. We're Toronto 2.0. We should be the favorite and a lock to win a championship. Well, the Clippers are not the Raptors. The Raptors, when Kawhi came into the Raptors, it was like a perfect storm. Like, everybody on that team kind of slid into a role. It took Kyle Lowry a little bit of time to get there, but he did eventually get there. Siakam knew his role on that team. Ibaka, Gasol, they knew their roles in that team. The Clippers didn't figure it out this year. They had guys that didn't know their roles, that wanted bigger roles, that maybe didn't understand the whole load management part with Kawhi. Like, there was a lot of inner issues with that team. I don't put that on Doc. I don't think Doc should have been the guy to, you know, kind of blend together this team to make it a championship team, to absolutely guarantee you a championship. Now, next year, if he didn't do it, all right, full season, you're out, that's it. But next year, Howard, is, I think, and it's not hyperbole, the most important season in the history of the Clippers franchise. Like, if they don't get to the finals and wind up losing one or more of Kawhi Leonard or Paul George, I don't know what they are for the next decade. They've traded all their assets away. They're kind of a middling playoff team with nowhere to go. So, to me, it's a pretty big gamble to let go of a proven coach in Doc Rivers when you're entering the most important season of your franchise history.
And you might find another coach who's maybe better at certain aspects of the job, or, you know, maybe they're, you know, whatever it may be, practice routines, simple X's and O's, out of bounds plays, whatever category you want to check. Let's say there's something that you're going to get in the next coach that's better than what Doc did by some degree. You're still also, though, losing on the other side of it one of the most definable and powerful personalities, charismatic personalities in the coaching ranks. And that matters in this league. Yes, there are some more, I would say, demure personalities, a Brad Stevens who just kind of fades into the woodwork, and Frank Vogel is kind of that mold too. There are guys who just kind of do, Taylor Jenkins in Memphis, like these guys who just, they're good game managers, they're good with their players, whatever, but they're not larger than life personalities. And I think that at times in this league, you need that. You need the credibility and the powers of persuasion that come with, a Doc Rivers who not only has the championship ring and the playing experience in this league, but has been around, has coached some of the best players in history, has coached Hall of Famers, has all that credibility, and just has this way about him as a communicator and as a just a powerful personality. And I think when you're trying to corral a bunch of different egos and guys with maybe differing agendas, you need that. Now, did he do that to the best possible ability this season? Maybe not, but that is one of his strengths. And so I think that that's more about, again, the circumstances of the season than about anything that Doc failed at. And I do think that given all of that, given the 1,000 different ways you could, put caveats on how this season unfolded, I think you owe it to yourself as a franchise to have him come back for next season, which is presumably going to be slightly more normal, may not be normal, but more so than this season. And if there's still problems, then okay, now maybe it's about the coach. But for a team that had this choppy of a season, not to have a normal season together, and without Paul George starting on the shelf because of his shoulders, like that, it just doesn't sit right. But again, there may be other pieces of this that we're not privy to yet that will come out in the days to come.
You know what I wonder about Ty Lue too? Do you think there'd be any hesitation on Ty's part to take a job like this? I mean, it's one thing to take the seat that David Blatt vacated. It's another to take the seat that your really close friend, mentor, the guy that brought you into the fold in LA, made you extremely highly paid assistant coach. Do you think there's any hesitation there from Ty Lue? I mean, look, Doc's a pretty magnanimous guy. I'm sure that Doc would say to Ty, if you have the opportunity, take it. But I wonder if there's any, because Ty's going to have some opportunities. I mean, whether it's New Orleans, Philly, he's in the mix for these jobs. I wonder if there'd be any hesitation on his part to take this job because of what happened with Doc Rivers.
I think Ty, the way he's built, I think there's definitely a strong loyalty factor there. But I think to something that you already alluded to, Doc, probably the first thing he would tell him would be, look, if they offer you the job and you want it, take it. Don't stand on ceremony over me. I had a good 7 years. But they do go way back. I mean, Doc is the one who gave him his first coaching job in Boston too.
Yep.
So, Ty's been with him a long time. There's probably, few people who are as important to Ty's career as Doc is. But, 30 jobs in this league and only a handful where you can say, I've got a chance to win a championship. If that's available to him, if that's the direction they want to go, I got to believe he probably takes it.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it'd just be interesting to see if he jumps at it or if he starts to see if what else is out there. If Philadelphia's real, if New Orleans is real. I'll be interested in the next couple of days. Last thing on the Clippers. Is there any chance that Steve Ballmer makes a phone call to Phil Jackson? Any chance that 75-year-old Phil Jackson has interest in this job?
No.
Come on! Wouldn't that be awesome?
I know you threw that out there. I know Kawakami, I think, might have alluded to it. Whatever. I was seeing, and then I saw, we get like 1,000 emails a day from the odds makers about all the ridiculous stuff you can bet on. Phil Jackson, 4-1 odds or whatever it was for the Clipper job. Give me a break. No. If Phil Jackson could still coach, if he were still physically up to the challenge of coaching, he would have coached the Knicks instead of being team president, or he would have coached any number of other teams in the last, whatever it's been, 9 years since he walked away from the Lakers after that catastrophe against the Mavericks. No. I would love to see it, but no.
You're no fun.
I'm sorry. I know. I'm Mr. Cold Water here.
First of all, I don't disagree with you, and mostly because Phil's 75 and his body's like a game of operation right now. Like, it's just, he's just a physical mess. Like, and it just happens when you play basketball that long and your body goes through what it goes through. I do think, Howard, though, and maybe it's just playing devil's advocate here, I think there's a part of Phil that would love to take the job just for the opportunity. Two reasons. One, to go back to LA, where he's obviously comfortable living, spent a lot of time there as a head coach. To stick it to the Lakers, who didn't exactly grant him the most graceful of exits as a head coach. When you you know, follow up what happened after Mike Brown, Mike D'Antoni, and all that stuff. I think there's a part of him that wouldn't mind sticking it. Plus, there's never been, Howard, a head coach that has won a championship with three teams. Like, Phil's already the all-time winningest coach in terms of championships, bested Red Auerbach. There's never been anyone that has won three on three different teams. He can best Pat Riley in this situation. I mean, you know Phil much better than I do. You know the competitive juices, even in a broken body, still flow through him.
Oh, there's no question about that. And I think that, I know people have always focused on, oh, well, $12 million a year for the Knicks, and it's about, he had plenty of money. He didn't need that headache. He didn't need any of that. But yes, the man is incredibly competitive, loves the game of basketball, and wanted to still be involved. And he saw that as a way to put his imprint from a little bit more of a distance. It didn't work out so well, clearly. But I will say this, actually, since we're going to keep going down this rabbit hole. In all seriousness, here's what I do know about Phil that I think is very it's substantial, it's meaningful, and it's definitely true. When he was toward the end of his coaching career in LA, and he was thinking about what the next thing would be and whether it would involve directly coaching, he talked at length about we sat down once for a story back in 2011 where he talked at length about wanting to be a mentor. And that's what I think led him on down this unfortunate path with the Knicks, was he thought that from the front office he could be a mentor to a first-time coach in Steve Kerr if Kerr would have taken the job, or to Derek Fisher, who ultimately ended up with a job. Hornacek obviously in there too. But like, he wanted to still, one, have the triangle be meaningful and relevant to the NBA, but two, to pass on everything else that he knew about running a team as a coach. And he thought he could do it as a mentor figure from the front office, not realizing, I think, or appreciating fully that job is about so much more than leading a coach. It's about all these 1,000 other things that have nothing to do with even the day-to-day of coaching. But he always talked about wanting to play this mentor role. That being the case, Chris Mannix, how about this scenario? What if it is Ty Lue, who counts Phil among his mentors, among his most influential, because that's where he started his career, was as a Lakers guard and was on that championship team that beat the Sixers back in 2001. And Ty Lue, I think, still has high regard for Phil. What if Phil finally was able to, because I don't think his ego before would have let him be an assistant, but much as Tex Winter was this incredible resource for him next to him on the bench, and we've seen others, Ron Adams next to Steve Kerr, maybe he could play that mentor role that he talked to me about 9 years ago as lead assistant or among the top assistants for Ty Lue, because then he doesn't have to be out on the court every day. He doesn't have to travel, which is a real problem for him at this stage of his life physically. Even if he weren't 75, even 5 years ago, that was what was standing in the way of him being a full-time head coach again, was just physically the travel, just all of it. So maybe he could be the lead assistant. I think he still has his place in Playa del Rey. That would be interesting.
I think though, like, for that to happen, Ty would have to buy into the triangle in the same way that Phil bought into the triangle with Tex Winter.
But right. But maybe because Ty has already now won a championship on his own as a head coach, and this would be his second head coaching job, he's got his own philosophy. He's melded, as a lot of coaches do, a little bit of Phil Jackson, a little bit of Doc Rivers, a little bit of what he picked up from Tibbs. Like, he could do it on his terms. He could say, I'd love to have you here for what you'll see in the course of a game, and for the things that you bring, just the day-to-day knowledge, just a sounding board, but I'm not running the triangle. We're going to do it my way. And tons of teams in the league use pieces of the triangle. Like, it still lives, but not as a complete 100% system from start to finish. So it could happen. I'm not saying that would happen.
Right.
It's plausible. It is more plausible than Phil Jackson coming back to head coach.
How bad do you think Phil wants to prove that the triangle can still be successful at a high level? Because, look, social media is stupid, but one of the pushbacks I got from even suggesting the Clippers should call Phil Jackson was that the triangle's outdated. It would never work in today's game. I happened to look at that Clippers team, Howard. I think Kawhi would be kind of perfect in the triangle in the same way Kobe was perfect in the triangle. I'm not sure how Paul George fits in there. Patrick Beverley Phil has coached non-dynamic offensive point guards before. Like, he's probably become a better three-point shooter. Like, I look at the Clippers roster, I'm like, you know, it kind of makes a lot of sense for the triangle. And the triangle, by the way, as you know full well, is not averse to three-point shooting. Like, it's not. No. It just sets it up in a very different way. So
yeah.
I look at the personnel kind of being a fit for that.
It's not crazy. I do think that, you know, the league has just moved beyond that. I think it doesn't have the currency that it needs. It doesn't have the buy-in that it needs. Also, today's players, much more so than during Phil's time, whether it was with the Bulls or the Lakers, today's players, especially the stars, they kind of want to do it their own way. There are no real intricate or very few intricate systems anymore. It's more about, here's a basic structure. You guys go do the rest yourself. It's a ton of pick and roll. Phil's like eschews that. It's not that he doesn't believe you should ever have a pick and roll, but he hates the heavy screen and roll game. He hates heavy isolation. Say like what Houston does. But yeah, listen, again, to the extent that the triangle, you can incorporate pieces of it as many teams do. He could be there for that part of it. And also, again, as a sounding board for Ty Lue, it makes sense to me. It would be interesting. I don't know that I could actually see it happening, but it'd be interesting.
I'm dying on this hill here. I'm just taking the Phil Jackson hill, and I'm dying on it. All right, a couple of things I want to hit with you on. The Celtics, they bow out. Third time last 4 years they've been to a conference finals. Come up short. This time probably hurts more than the others because I don't know that the Heat were measurably better than them in the same way that, you know, LeBron and the Cavaliers were a better team back in those days. A lot of criticism being heaped at this point on Brad Stevens. I mean, I guess your 10,000 foot view of the Celtics loss. I mean, how disappointing was it to see them kind of go out like that?
This is one of those things where being the distanced, emotionally completely cut off reporter, like, puts me in a weird at odds with a fan base, right? Because I think Celtics fans are nuts if they're freaking out over this. I don't think this should be some major disappointment. I just don't. Jason Tatum, I think I heard somewhere, is 22. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Allegedly.
Mentioned every five minutes during every broadcast.
No birth certificate yet, so we'll have to wait.
Let's not even go down that path. Your star player is 22 and still evolving and looks like he's an eventual MVP candidate, but he's not there yet. And there are aspects of his game, whether it's shooting, whether it's playmaking, that he's still got to, and sometimes just remembering that he has teammates, that he still has to evolve into. And when you don't have that kind of focal point, it makes it harder for everybody else. And plus, you know, look, they were missing Gordon Hayward for a long stretch. They got him back toward the end. Kemba Walker, who knows how bad that knee was all season. And they were also trying to balance when they had all four of those guys. Okay, we got four guys who are all great with the ball in their hands, which is a luxury, but it also can sometimes create some bumpiness. So what was the stat you threw out? Three times in 4 years that they've lost in
conference finals. Yeah.
In the conference finals, you could argue that a couple of those times they shouldn't have even been there.
Yeah.
And this team has changed dramatically in the course of that 4 year run. So this is not the same team that was losing in those previous ones. And at that time, those were like, oh wow, I can't even believe they're here. Yes, I do think on paper they had more talent, especially offensive talent, than the Heat, but that's discounting the power and influence of somebody like Jimmy Butler on your roster. You know, Jimmy Butler makes everything make sense around him. Jimmy Butler drives everything around him. And the Celtics, Jason Tatum may someday become that guy, but he's 22. Jimmy Butler's 30. Like, he's just not there yet. They could have won this series. They had the talent to win this series. I don't even consider it an upset. I didn't consider it an upset necessarily that the Heat beat the Bucks, except in the most technical terms of you know, well, you look at their records and their seeding. Okay, it's an upset. Yeah, I get it. But the Heat are that good. And yeah. I don't think Boston has much to be upset about. They've got two phenomenal young players who are built for today's NBA in Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. Long, tall, multi-skilled, can guard multiple positions and play multiple roles on offense. That is a phenomenal foundation that they'll have for years to come. And that's where the focus should be, is how to strengthen around them.
Yeah, as much as anything, I think it was a missed opportunity just because I think it gets tougher next year. You know, I think Golden State is going to be back in the mix next year, and you know, who knows what they look like if they decide to keep the draft pick, trade the draft pick in their own conference. I'm going to assume the Bucks keep Giannis and get a little bit better because they'll put all their chips on the table to try to keep him long-term. The Nets, and they've got some star power stepping in there. Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, we'll see if they develop chemistry, but on paper, they look like a formidable group. I just think the road gets tougher for the Celtics this year, and this just feels like a missed opportunity for them to put something together.
Yeah, we could certainly look at it that way, especially if you think like, oh, all bets were off because, you know, the championship was practically vacated by Kawhi leaving Toronto, and the East was a little unsettled, and the bubble made things even more ambiguous in terms of the pecking order. Like, yeah, okay, yes. The opportunity was there in a unique way this year. And you're right. It should get harder next year, right? Like, we don't know who Philly's going to hire or how they're going to retool around those guys, but Philly should be in the mix. The Nets should be in the mix. The Bucks should still be in the mix. Boston should be in the mix. The Heat will still be in the mix. As of September 29th, as we're discussing this, those things are all true. But you and I both know, Chris, like, things go haywire. What if Giannis decides, I'm not signing the Supermax, and in fact, I'd like to be traded. I don't think that's the way it's going to play out there, but it could. And Milwaukee's got some age issues after Giannis and Chris Middleton. Like, that roster, are we sure that they're going to be back toward the top next season if they just run it back with the same group? Are we sure that the Sixers' chemistry is going to get any better? Are we sure that Kevin Durant is going to be whatever percentage of himself after Achilles? And my gosh, we haven't seen him. It's now been 15 months. And it'll be, 18, 20 months in between games for him. We have no idea. KD and Kyrie have never played together. Steve Nash has never coached. They should be really good. They should be a, 55-win team. I don't know. So I think there's enough volatility that the Celtics don't have to worry about, like, the door slamming shut. And Toronto's in a really interesting position, too, because Gasol and Ibaka, free agents, Van Vliet a free agent who, somebody might try to max him out. There's no guarantee that the Raptors are back in this mix. So I don't think that there's this this urgency that they needed to do this now. It was now or never kind of thing. Like, I think that they've got a long window.
Yeah, they certainly have a long window to be a contender. I think what gets them to the next level is how they draft the next couple of years. And if we're being completely honest, outside of like these top five picks that they acquired in the previous trades, they haven't been great with some of these draft picks. I mean, Romeo Langford, let's give him a pass for this year. He was injured for most of it, but let's see what he can bring next year. But right now, Tyler Hero, the player picked right before him, looks like a much more formidable player. You go back a few years, I mean, the Celtics drafted Gershon Yabusele and Ante Zizic over Pascal Siakam. Like, this is how championship teams are built, Howard. They're built, through stars. You know, guys like, Tatum and Brown can be the alphas on a championship team, but rosters are fleshed out with good draft picks. And the Celtics in recent years just haven't made those draft picks. And they've got another big one. Like, I look at this year's draft, number 14 overall, that pick they got from Memphis, that's huge. Like, don't come to me with this is a weak draft, because 3 years from now, there's going to be like three players in that range that turn out to be players. Like, who thought Tyler Hero was going to be a significant player on a finals team this time last year? Like, you don't. Like, I don't want to hear about weak draft. I don't want to hear about any of it. You got to hit on this pick. This pick, not to put too much pressure on it, but what they do with it, it could be the difference between a finals appearance next season and maybe no finals appearance for a few years. They're just that important.
But there are other levers that they can pull, right? Like, Gordon Hayward, I think, is going into the last year of his deal. And despite his injury history recently, I think he still has a lot of value out there to teams. Like, if you want to start playing the trade route, if you want to start, playing around the margins in other ways, I think they do have options. But you're right. When you're a really good team and you're no longer – and when that cache of draft picks that you've acquired over the years starts running a little thin and you haven't made the most of them, it starts to get tough, because you know, you're getting maxed out on the salary cap. You're up against luxury tax. You just don't have as much breathing room, and you need, you know, for lack of a better term, the cheap labor that comes with, you know, getting really hitting on your draft picks with controlled cost rookie deals that are much lower than guys' market value. And if you don't, it makes it really tough to sustain something long term. The good news is, you know, the two guys are young enough, and Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, that you can get out from under your cap issues. You can keep retooling around them. You can, and you've become, I don't know how long this lasts, but they were never a free agent destination. And then suddenly they were when Gordon Hayward picked them, and then Kemba Walker picked them. Like maybe they have shaken off whatever that, you know, that cloud was, where the Celtics now, despite being a cold weather northeastern city, despite anything else, teams, you know, good players will want to pick them, and they don't need the max guys. Now they've got two studs to build around. They just need the high level role players who think, yeah, I want to hitch my wagon there because I think they've got a chance to make a run or two.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think they get it through the draft. I think that's where teams find these guys, that cheap labor you're talking about, and those are the guys to propel them to the next level. Like, where would the Raptors be without Pascal Siakam? Like, they wouldn't have won a championship last year. You know, when Kawhi slowed down a little bit in the finals, Siakam stepped up, made huge plays, especially in that clincher. So I think this draft coming up for Boston is huge. Let me finish with this. The finals start on Wednesday. Not to oversimplify it, but do you have something you're looking for in this series that could tilt it one way or the other? Some variable matchup, how a team plays. What are you looking for as the series begins?
I'm most curious about whether anybody on the Lakers not named LeBron and Anthony Davis will do something of note. That has been a question for them since day one. That, you know, look, they're in the finals, so credit to that supporting cast. They have, they're there despite anything that those of us in the punditry would have wondered about. Like, there is no one guy that leaps out as being like, okay, that's the guy if LeBron's having an off night. And that's the thing. Like, the Heat are a really good defensive team. They have the kind of personnel to make LeBron inefficient, potentially. I'm not predicting that will happen, but look, Iguodala has done it before. Granted, it's been a few years, but they have Andre Iguodala. They've got Jay Crowder. They've got Jimmy Butler. They've got Bam Adebayo. Like, they've got, you know, no one guy is going to stop LeBron, and we know that. But they have an arsenal of guys who they can rotate on LeBron or any combination of them, and we know LeBron's always going to make the right basketball play. He's going to give up the ball. If AD is on the court, maybe every time he gives it up, it's to AD for an easy dunk. Maybe. But you're going to need guys to make shots. Right now, their three-point shooting in the playoffs is actually way beyond what you'd expect it to be. I was looking it up earlier, like Rondo is shooting 44% or something from three. But how much are you really relying on, you know, Rondo and Caruso and Kuzma and these guys to make all those open threes? You know, can they sustain that against a Heat team that's really quick defensively? That's the whole thing. You know, LeBron is going to, especially at age 35, in his 17th year, and without any, you know, guarantee that he'll ever get this chance again. Like, this was a chance that a lot of people thought wouldn't come around again, period. And here he is. He's this close to a fourth championship, and, you know, nothing's guaranteed. So I think we will see the best of LeBron, but I think we will see the best of the Heat trying to do everything possible to make him inefficient and make some of those role guys on the Lakers beat them. I don't know if those guys are up for it or not. I've got, if we're going to do predictions here, I think Lakers in seven sounds about right to me, because I do think the Heat have the ability to push them that hard. I don't think this is AD is awesome. He's the second best player in the series, but as a lot of people have been pointing out in the last day or so, and I don't disagree, wherever you want to draw the line, after those two, you can make the case that whatever, four of the next six, five of the next six are the Heat. They've got a better array in general on that roster.
Yeah, I like the Lakers in five, but wow. I don't say that. Look, like, what was it? I think it was 28 or 2017. When the Warriors beat the Cavaliers in five, and it, like, on paper, it's like, well, Warriors won in a row, but you and I were there. It wasn't. It was Kevin Durant like doing superhuman things to win games at the wire. So you can lose a series in five games, still have it be ultra competitive.
Agreed.
I think LeBron at the end of these games is going to be too tough to stop. I throw out the regular season record because, I mean, back then Tyler Hero was playing behind Kendrick Nunn. Back then Andre Iguodala and Jay Crowder were not part of those teams.
Right.
So it's entirely different. What is a constant and something I worry about is that Anthony Davis kicked the crap out of Bam Adebayo. Like, you look at the numbers. Like, Davis averaged like 30, and Adebayo averaged less than 12. And they both played a significant amount of minutes in both those matchups. I don't remember if they were matched up the entire time, but I would assume it was a lot of the time in that game. That can't happen. Like, Adebayo has to play like conference finals Adebayo. Like, he has got to be great for the Heat to have a chance. I think Spoelstra's going to throw some of those, you know, janky defenses that we've seen in the past at the Heat. I think you'll see some zone in that series, try to make those Lakers shooters come up big. But to me, a big matchup to watch is Adebayo versus AD. Like, I think they'll both be matched up with each other for significant portions of the series, and how that matchup goes is going to be huge, because you can't just get run over in the way Davis did to Adebayo in the two games of the series.
Yeah, I agree. The only concern I'd have if I'm the Heat, though, is like, I don't want Adebayo on AD so much that he ends up in foul trouble, because AD's bigger and stronger, and Adebayo's a phenomenal defender, and I think he's got the ability to bother him without fouling. But if he's on him every minute that they're both in the game, I'd be worried. I don't want Bam taken out of rhythm or having to then play cautiously. He's important as a role man for them too, and as a scorer. Not a primary scorer, but like they score by committee, right? Like, Jimmy could drop 40 on a given night, and Hero might go off, and Dragic might go off, but for the most part, they're a score by committee kind of team, and Adebayo is part of that. So I would be a little concerned about having him in foul trouble if he's got too much AD responsibility. I wonder if you dust off, you know, Myers Leonard to go like bang around on him for a while and just spend some fouls and try to wear him out, and Kelly Olynyk, whoever, just starts, you know, throwing sacrificial lambs out there.
you really are throwing sacrificial lambs out there, because I mean, Myers Leonard, I think Myers Leonard was starting for that team during the regular season matchups, and I don't recall him being all that effective.
I didn't say he'd be effective. I you know,
he just, what are you looking for in something like that? Just a guy, just a body.
Bruises. Yeah,
Myers Leonard, when the Lakers beat the Heat by 50 in the first game, Myers Leonard played 12 minutes as a starter. Kelly Olynyk played 30. So there's your front line right there. And Anthony Davis had himself, what was his final number there? 26 points. 8 rebounds, 7 assists. You can't have that be the outcome of this game. I mean, I agree.
I'm just
with
saying
you.
I want to protect Bam a little.
Yeah, I agree with you. You don't play him, you know, until you get to the fourth quarter. You probably try to mix and match and give him a break there. But at some point, they're going to be matched up, and he's got to come up big. I think we both can agree on that. He's going to have a huge series to win. Howard, always appreciate it, man. Enjoy these conversations, and we will talk next when Phil Jackson is being introduced as the new coach of the Clippers, okay?
I look forward to that one. Thanks, Chris.
Appreciate it, Howard. Coming up next, Mike Breen. All right, joining me now on the show, a very familiar voice to every NBA fan out there. He is calling his 15th NBA Finals this week for ABC and ESPN. He is the voice of the NBA, Mike Breen. What's up, Mike?
Oh, Chris. How are you, bud?
Well, happy to be out of the bubble, but out a couple of weeks. I feel like my health has improved. My eating habits have improved. Everything has improved since my two-month stint in the bubble. So you're still immersed in it, but how's that going for you?
I'll be equally as happy when I leave as you were. You know, as you know, it's just quite the experience. There's part of it that is just, you know, you feel like you're part of history. You know, being so unprecedented in terms of the circumstances, there's something fascinating about seeing how it all plays out. It's remarkable how they've been able to make it work. But then there's also, you know, it's an emotional challenge when you're away from your family and your friends. And it gives you an idea of what the players are going through, because it's, you know, the human element has played, I think, in my opinion, an enormous role. And I think it's been underplayed a little bit. So as somebody who's experienced that human element and really looking forward to going home, you know, it's had its ups and downs. But overall, I think it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in terms of it all coming together and working.
Yeah. When it comes to that human element, how have you seen that kind of manifest itself? I mean, I think you're right that the human element is a variable in these playoffs like it's never been before. But when you say that, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think you can even see teams and players, the disparity in their performances from game to game, sometimes even from half to half, is pretty wide. And, you know, you've seen some terrific players have some brutal games. You've seen some teams that look like they are, you know, just world beaters one night, and then the next night, not that they look disinterested, but there's not that same intensity. And I think that plays a large part of it in terms of the consistency of play. I think overall the play is so much better than I ever thought it was going to be before I came down here. But you've seen some real inconsistency in terms of, again, I don't want to use intensity or effort. There's some nights it looks like something's missing.
Yeah, there definitely is a mental factor to all that with guys having to kind of go through what is effectively Groundhog's Day every single day inside that bubble. For your purposes, Mike, usually you're right there courtside calling the game from a very close vantage point. Now, you've done obviously games in the past where you haven't had that same vantage point, but what's it been like to work in these elements, to be behind the glass, I don't know what it is, 20, 30 feet away from courtside? What's that experience been like?
It's, you know, Chris, it's been a challenge. I don't want to make it sound like any kind of hardship. I mean, mm-hmm. we're staying in a beautiful hotel and we're taken care of, but from a, you know, a play-by-play standpoint, and I think Mark and Jeff would feel the same way. It's a challenge because we are about, I'd say, 20 or 30 rows back. The plexiglass is just, it's just so different that you're separated. So, you know, you don't have that immediacy in terms of the connection right there. And because we've worked together so long, we're able to go through it. And just, you know, from a vantage point of calling the game, it's different. I miss being up close. I think that's a big part of, you know, seeing what's going on, being able to feel the intensity or seeing the anger or the nerves of a player, see it in their eyes, or a coach or an official. So you miss some of that. But the biggest thing that I miss, and I think everybody feels the same way, I have so underappreciated, at least I feel this way now, what fans bring to the event. What they bring to the event for the players, what they bring to the event for us as broadcasters, and even for the viewers at home. It's such a special part of the experience. And myself personally, you know, I use the crowd quite a bit in how I call a game. And I've had to make some adjustments. And there's some nights where, you know, you're making calls and you normally use the crowd and you wonder, you know, did I get it right? Was I screaming too much? Was I not talking enough? So it's you know, again, it's a challenge. It's been really a fascinating challenge, but it's so different that it presents a challenge.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that about the crowd, because there were a half dozen times early on when I almost wasn't sure if I was seeing a big play, if that makes any sense. Like, I think even the first time it happened was the very first seeding game between the Lakers and the Clippers, when LeBron had like this incredible offensive and defensive possession to help the Lakers win that game. And usually like the crowd, I don't know if it tells you it's a big play, but it kind of affirms that it was a big play or a big sequence. And I'm watching that with my eyes. I'm like, that was one of the best offensive defensive sequences I've ever seen. I don't know if you had any kind of similar experience where, you know, something incredible happens, but without the crowd, you're almost like, did I really see that accurately? Am I sure that was the same play I thought it was?
Oh, absolutely, especially at the end of games, because it's still so quiet in there. I know they have the virtual fans and some of the music and the PA, but it's just still so quiet. So there've been a number of times where I thought, well, maybe I shouldn't have gotten that excited, but you know, just so used to seeing such extraordinary things from these players. So you just go with your experience on something like that. But I've had a couple of times where I completely missed a play. There was Eric Gordon took a shot, and from the angle I had, it looked like it hit the bottom of the net, went under the rim, and I'm calling it good. And thankfully, Jeff said to me, Mike, that was an air ball. And the other night, I misidentified a player because he was through a couple of things, so it was hard. So there's almost like a, for me, there's a little pause before you make some calls because you have to make sure, because you don't have the same vantage point, and it just looks all so different than what we're used to.
I think you mixed up Tatum and Cantor on the one play, but I don't blame you for that, Mike, because Cantor has the greatest, or had the greatest, Orlando tan you've ever seen in your life. Like his skin changed like three shades from the amount of time he spent outside.
Thank you so much for giving me a built-in excuse for but it's all part of it, and it's okay. Came from my standpoint, I always say, you make mistakes every game. You just hope they're not at a big moment.
Is this the most time you've spent with Mark and Jeff in one period?
Well, if it's not, it certainly feels like it. No, there's no question. Quite honestly, that's been one of the real saving graces, is that we've had all this time together. And the interesting thing is Mark and Jeff, who never play golf, and I love golf, they have become addicted to the game, and they're starting to play more than I am. And so that camaraderie has been fun. I mean, we've been together so long, to have something new like that to have fun with. But that's what has saved us, is having having some extra time together that we normally wouldn't, because you're normally getting on a flight and you're going home for a day or two. And, so that stuff has helped. But I do miss, and I know you feel the same way. I miss the face-to-face contact with the coaches and the players and team officials and league officials. I mean, that's as fun part of the job as calling the games, the relationships and the friendships. And we're not in the same bubble as the players and coaches. So we have zero face-to-face interaction with them. Everything is done on Zoom. So I missed that part. So we're cherishing the part of at least having each other in the bubble to kind of get us through this.
Spending as much time with them as you have, who wants to be a head coach again more, Mark Jackson or Jeff Van Gundy?
I think for both of them, not to give you a cop-out answer, Chris, but I think it's in their blood. Jeff is obviously coached more years in the league, but Mark was, to me, he was such a natural when he was at Golden State, and he did such a good job. And the fact that, it didn't end the way he wanted it to, and it's taken this long for him to get another chance. I don't get it. I don't understand. If you're a team and you want to have your team reach potential, both of these guys will do that. And I say that objectively. They're fantastic coaches. And I know they would both love to have another shot, because it's something that they're good at, and it's something that's in their blood.
If you lost one of them next year, would you want a third in your booth, or would you want to go with one with just two?
You're asking me decisions that are way above my.
You've got input.
I will say this: a three-man booth is, or a three-woman booth, or wherever it's set up, is a difficult thing to coordinate from a standpoint of the two analysts. I think two things have to happen. Number one, they have to respect each other and respect their basketball knowledge. And the second thing is you have to like each other. And these two have such a unique relationship of respect and admiration that it really works. There's never a fight for airtime. There's no egos. And most importantly, when the three of us have this, if somebody says something that either I think is wrong, or Jeff or Mark, like, it'll come right at you. Nobody's feelings get hurt. In fact, we always talk about that. If somebody makes a mistake, correct it. Or if somebody disagrees with something, come at me. And I think it really works. And it's hard. And to get that special dynamic that those two have, to me, that's what makes it work. And for me, all I have to do when I'm working with two is I've got to pull back a little more. I don't talk as much, And it's so easy when it's those two guys, because their chemistry that they have and the way they go back and forth, to me, is it's informative and it's entertaining.
So there was a faction of people, Mike, that believed coming into this that this would be an asterisk championship, that it wouldn't be it shouldn't be recognized as a legitimate title. And we've gone down this path before with what was the 99 Spurs and even the shortened season back in 2011, where people would say, it's not a real... You remember Phil Jackson gave voice to that back in the early 2000s when he commented on the Spurs championships. Did you have a feeling on whether it should be considered an asterisk championship not coming in, and has having experienced what you've experienced and seen what you've seen, has that affected how you view the outcome of this series?
My coming into it, I believe the asterisk was necessary, but for a good reason, not because it wasn't as good. I felt before I came down here, I thought that this was going to be one of those championships that people will talk about in 20 years from now, the team that won it in the bubble, because it's completely different from anything any of these players have ever experienced. The circumstances are so unprecedented that to overcome these different obstacles, to me, is so impressive. Again, excuse me, they're staying in lush hotels. They've got everything at their fingertips in terms of what they need. But this is not how they were, you know, born and bred in the NBA. This is not how it's supposed to happen. And self-motivation is enormous in terms of bringing that energy every day, being able to overcome, you know, missing that family. For example, I have three adult children. I can't imagine having small children and being away from them. It's hard enough for me being away from my adult children. I can't imagine to be able to do that. And then you get the calls from home about, he's not sleeping, or so-and-so is not feeling well. It's just, it's such an emotional roller coaster here. And now that I've been here and experienced that on my level, and I'm not the one out there running up and down the court, I think it's even more impressive what they've been able to do and what they've been able to overcome. And for me, and I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I think this is an historic championship. And the team that wins this, for them to be able to overcome and deal with all the differences that they've had, something they've never experienced, is remarkable.
Yeah, I came in feeling like it might be a questionable championship because of, you know, who was going to be playing, you know, no home court advantage here or there. What if something crazy happens like it did in 99 when the Knicks made that run all the way to the finals in a lockout shortened season? But having experienced it, I'm with you. I mean, this might be one of the hardest championships ever won, especially for the teams or team singular that's been here from start to finish and wins it. Like that to me will be a tremendous accomplishment. 3+ months of isolation, effective isolation with your teammates and a handful of family at the very end. And I've found, Mike, that, you know, family is being incorporated into all this. A lot of guys there didn't really want their family down there. They started viewing it as like a job. It's like, look, let's just put our head down and get through this, and we'll suffer in silence, so to speak. We don't need the energy of new people coming in that don't have our responsibilities in there. I think this will be right up there with one of the greatest accomplished championships that I've ever witnessed.
And you also, you add into the fact that while they're in this bubble, while they're in this isolation, what's going on in the country with the pandemic, with the social unrest and the fight for social justice, all this stuff together while they're in there just adds to anxiety. And, you know, Paul George came out and said, you know, that after that one game that the bubble got the best of him and got depressed. And you know, mental health issues to me is one of the most under-talked about problems we have in the country. And now because of, you know, courageous players, and I don't use that word courageous very often, but courageous players like Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan and what George did, it's the impact that can have on people who might be hesitant to talk about issues they go through. And it's a real thing down here and for these players, and you know, everything like that impacts them, and so much of it is so important to them that you add all those factors in, and I agree with you. I think this is one of the hardest championships to win.
Last thing I want to ask you about, you 15th year doing these finals, that means you've seen every single one of LeBron's appearances in the finals, dating back to 2007 with the Cavaliers. You know, we don't know the outcome of this series yet, but this finals run for LeBron, I mean, where do you place it amongst some of his, you know, greater accomplishments, whether it was the team in 07 where it was LeBron and kind of a bunch of guys that had really no business being, you know, star players on a finals team, you know, coming back from 3-1 down, that I guess that was the outcome of that series, but that's a team in 2016 that upended the Warriors. I mean, where do you place this in kind of the pantheon of LeBron James accomplishments?
It has to be up there. I don't know if I'm going to rank it 1, 2, or 3, whatever. You know, the championships in Miami were, it's almost like that was expected. It was his time. He had great players with him, and he led them to back-to-back titles. I thought the Cleveland championship was, you know, for me, that was always his shining moment from a standpoint of the pressure that he felt to bring that championship to that city. It was so important for him to go back there. That was the number one priority, really the only priority for him going back to Cleveland, was to bring that city a championship and to do it the way they did it after trailing 3-1. I thought, how can you possibly top that? But what he's done this year, again, with what we just talked about, with the unprecedented circumstances, the stoppage of play, and then to come back, he's just, you know, he's the definition of legendary, because I always feel, you know, there are two things, and the main one is to have sustained excellence for so many years. I mean, it's off the charts. It's hard to fathom that he's been this good for this long. You know, we always talk about players being in their prime, their athletic prime. He's had the longest prime of anybody who's ever played sports, for crying out loud. I mean, the prime just keeps going. He shows no signs of really declining. And his commitment to being in the best physical shape is, I think people underestimate how tough that is at somebody at his age performing in this particular way. And the last thing is, it's always been about the team with him. Always. You know, if we draw up all the key points of what we want from our star athletes, every box is checked, because it starts with what matters is winning. What matters is being a great teammate. And that's what his whole career has been about, even though his individual accolades are as good as anybody's ever done it.
You know, we always compare Michael and LeBron, and look, LeBron's chasing a championship at 35. Michael won a championship, his last championship, in his mid-30s. When you look at the way those two guys have their games have aged and how they've adapted to their older age, I mean, do you see similarities there? I mean, how do you look at that when, you know, Jordan was able to win a championship at, I think it was 34, 35 against, I think it was Utah the last time around, and the way LeBron's trying to do it now? How do you compare them trying to do something at this stage of their careers?
Well, I think they've, both of them, you know, clearly couldn't do certain things physically at this age that they couldn't do, you know, that they did earlier in their career. But there are certain things that they did better, and they adjusted, and they used their experience and their smarts and their attention to detail in terms of their opponent and their, not just their opponent, but their teammates and what their teammates do well, how to make their teammates better. I felt both of them, you know, they're both, again, the numbers that they put up for themselves are staggering, but I feel both of them have learned how to be better teammates as they get older, and knowing what's this guy's strength and that guy's strength and what might be his weakness and their ability to, I mean, LeBron knows his opponents as well as anybody. I think it was Cook who was saying that during the finals when he was with Golden State, he's talking about LeBron is calling out Golden State sets before the Golden State was. Like he scouted the team so much. And we just spoke to Anthony Davis about an hour ago, and he said that he was in his room the other night. It was a Monday night. And LeBron has like a stack of papers, all scouting reports on Miami, both team-wise and individual-wise. So, you know, they adjusted to what they may have lost athletically to what's up in their head and their brain in terms of still providing that edge that they need.
Speaking of intelligence, are you looking forward to the Tom Thibodeau era in New York?
Yes, I am. You know, I first met Tom when he was an assistant with the Knicks, and his, you know, it just, his basketball mind is always churning, always looking for new angles, always looking to do something better. And, you know, the Knicks have had obviously a really rough stretch, but I've always felt with Tom, his whole approach is the no excuse approach. So even when his teams, you know, say in Chicago, Derrick Rose goes down, that's okay. We still have enough to win. There was never an excuse that you couldn't win that particular night. And I think that's what's important that he's bringing. Obviously, they've got to upgrade the roster because they just, you know, they just need to get better talent. But I am confident that whatever the roster is, that roster will reach its potential and win more games than you expected because he holds everybody accountable, including himself.
Yeah, I remember, and Tibbs confirmed this to me when I asked him years later, but the first season he was out of the game in Chicago when he got let go, he went back and he watched every single game he's ever coached. Like, that was how he spent his next year, just sitting in, I think it was like the Waldorf or wherever it was in Chicago, just watching every single game back. It's that kind of, those basketball minds, Mike. I mean, he's up there. He's an intense one, that's for sure.
You know, we always talk about players coming back the next year with something new to their game and how they improve. I don't think that we give enough credit. The coaches do that too. You know, they spend their off seasons, they're not working on their jumper or their handle. They're working on their defensive schemes. They're working on their motivation skills. And they improved. And I think every great coach, that's a big thing, is they come back better or they learn from a situation what they didn't do well in a certain city when they go to a new team. And it's, I think he's been one like that throughout his career.
Last thing for you, and this is more of a question about a gut feeling that you may or may not have. There's a job opening now in Los Angeles. Could you ever see Phil Jackson getting back into the coaching ranks?
I hate to do speculation on no idea, but if you want to just ask for my gut with no idea, I'm going to say no. I don't think he'd want to do that right now. I think he's pretty comfortable in where his life's at.
Yeah, I would guess. If it wasn't Los Angeles, I would completely rule it out. But I wonder. I wonder if there's a phone call to Montana to see what Phil's up to and how's it going up there.
Yeah, I mean, coaches are they're a different breed, and it's something they'll do for the rest of their lives. And if you throw an offer, I wouldn't say he wouldn't think about it. Maybe he would think about it, but that would be quite the story.
Hey, Larry Brown would still coach somewhere if anybody offered Larry a job. Like, sure, high school, absolutely. I'll take the gig. Mike, good luck this week. 15th NBA Finals. You can catch it all on ABC and ESPN. Always a pleasure to catch up with you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Thanks, my friend. Always a pleasure, Chris.